Anthony Achavadi traveled to India on a Fulbright Fellowship in 2005. His plan was to spend a year mapping the Ganges River Basin through the annual monsoon cycles. But the project wound up taking almost 10 years, and now he's issued his findings in a book from Applied Research and Design Publishing called Ganges Water Machine, Designing New India's Ancient River. Mr. Achavadi teaches in the Urban Design Program at Columbia University's Graduate School of Architecture, Planning, and Preservation. He's also recently written an op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Ganges Water Crisis, and I'm very pleased all of that has brought him to our show. Hello.
Hello, Leonard. It's great to be here with you.
Weren't there already accurate maps of the Ganges River Basin? Why did you want to map it for yourself?
Well, I wanted to map it because it hadn't been mapped in almost 50 years when I arrived in India or when I wrote the Fulbright proposal initially. So it actually hadn't been mapped extensively for almost 50 years. And yet it was one of the world's most densely populated river basins.
And it's my sense you also wanted to create some different kinds of maps?
Exactly. Given just the monsoon, like you were mentioning, and its kind of periodic changes that it produces of changing the landscape from being arid and dry to incredibly wet and gelatinous, and the 200 million people that live in the state of Uttar Pradesh, it seemed to me that there needed to be a kind of new form of mapping to better understand the cycles of the space.
Was your original idea to do all of this in a year a little too optimistic?
It was definitely too optimistic. Hubris is a great way to describe it.
Well, how could you have known?
That's a good point. But I probably should have imagined that taking on such a large project would eat up so much more time than a year.
You've described this book as a combination atlas and almanac. Why do you need an almanac component in mapping the Ganges?
It's a great question. So, there's a kind of choreography to the river, to the way people inhabit it, to the way people use it. And this kind of cycle is very much intertwined with the monsoon. So oftentimes when we think about maps, they're oftentimes static kind of mappings of space. But an almanac introduces this element of time. And so that was really critical to me to start to bring in that element of time and to create this dynamic atlas.
So a map of the river in January might look totally different from one that was made in August?
Exactly. I mean, sometimes the river might only be like 10 meters wide at a certain point in the year, like January, and then can go to 2 kilometers wide in August, September. So it's really incredibly dynamic just in that way in terms of the riverbed changing its shape and the volume of water that's passing through there.
How long is the Ganges and how large an area does its basin occupy?
So the Ganges is roughly 1,600 miles long.
Does that include its tributaries?
That doesn't include all of its tributaries. But to give you some kind of relationship, like the Mississippi is 2,320 miles long, roughly. The Ganges Basin, though, it's fascinating because it's only 1.1 million square kilometers, but say the Mississippi is 3.1 million or the Amazon is 6 million square kilometers, yet over 400 million people live in this area.
And very few people live along much of the Amazon.
Exactly. Amazon, probably we're talking like 20 million people maybe live in the basin.
Well, how does it compare to the Danube, which would have some population density, and the Mississippi as well?
It definitely has some population density, probably more similar, I would say, to the Danube in terms of just the level of density, but even still, like if you imagine...
Or the Nile, I guess, is another one.
The Nile is definitely closer, and definitely in that situation, you have more people kind of hugging the edges of the river there. In this case, it's a much more kind of diffuse urbanization that's
Since the river changes its shape, do people in the basin see things like housing or agricultural land as a temporary thing?
For sure. One of the things I look at is, for example, where the Ganges and the Jamuna rivers meet, called the Triveni Sangam in the city of Allahabad. Every year, there's a very large festival. A couple million people come there during January, February. A city grid is laid down. People leave this celebration, this Magh Mela, and the lines of the city are still etched into the sandbars. People move in and use those that gridded city for agriculture, and then they harvest crops from it, and the monsoon comes and washes all of that away.
Is that why during the year of your Fulbright you based yourself in Allahabad, where the Ganges and the Jamuna rivers meet?
Yes. I was definitely interested in being at a kind of both a kind of sacred site within India, but also at an extremely dynamic site. And I thought this kind of the choreography that I might be able to witness there might lead into kind of other insights along the river corridor.
And when you were there for your first year, how soon did you realize that it was going to take several more years?
Well, I still was hoping, even at the end of it, Leonard, that I would finish it in a year, but. I probably once I came back to the States and I got a grant from the Ford Foundation, I realized that this project was just becoming a lot larger and that to just do a little portion of the river wasn't enough of the story.
What kind of equipment were you using? Were you able to take aerial photographs or were you stuck to working mostly on the ground?
So I was mostly on the ground because, you know, when I arrived in India, Google Earth had only just been launched in June of 2005. I arrived actually 10 years ago to this day. In India, and the aerial photographs you could get on Google Earth were incredibly low resolution. And the maps, I couldn't find any maps, and eventually I found out that most recent maps were almost 50 years old, so I had to kind of walk the Earth a little bit like Kane in Kung Fu.
My guess is Anthony Achavadi. His book, Ganges Water Machine, Designing New India's Ancient River. Did you originally intend to document the entire length of the Ganges from its source in the Himalayas to where it empties into the Bay of Bengal?
No. So my initial project was just to map between this city, Allahabad, or it's spelled Allahabad, and Varanasi, which is about a 200-kilometer stretch. But I eventually took it all the way to Patna, which is a couple more hundred kilometers further southeast, and all the way up to the glacier.
The Ganges is sacred to Hindus. How does that affect the practical aspects of managing the river?
Well, it definitely complicates it because it's revered for its kind of sacred and holy powers and its significance within kind of Hindu and Indian culture at large. But yet it's also a kind of major site for sewage runoff, industrial waste. So it's very complicated in terms of trying to manage that and kind of sync those two issues.
Well, it's a source of water for the region, both for drinking and irrigation. But during the time you were there in 2007, the Ganges was ranked as the fifth most polluted river in the world. And I would assume that not only threatens humans, but also all of the various fish species that live there, the amphibian species, and isn't there a Ganges River dolphin?
Yes, there is. So there's this beautiful, it's called a Susu, Ganges River dolphin. They are probably close to extinction at this point.
Because of the pollution?
It's a mixture of pollution, kind of building dams, fishing. People are fishing them and eating them and selling them. So it's a mixture of issues that are affecting the kind of extinction of, or soon to be extinction.
Have there been efforts to clean up the river?
There have been numerous efforts. Probably the biggest one began in 1985, called the Ganga Action Plan, which was to build all of these sewage treatment plants. It's largely been seen as a complete failure in terms of its ability to clean up the river. And now there are new efforts underway, initiated in 2010 with the World Bank to try to clean up the river.
Does all the water that comes in from the monsoons clear it up a little bit?
The monsoon waters definitely help kind of recharge the basin, and especially the river. But even still, because about 85% of the pollution in this river is from sewage, which is, of course, going into it year-round.
Well, why even continue to pour the sewage into it if people know that they're going to use the same river to bathe in, to drink water from, to put on their crops?
Well, so a lot of people, I mean, you know, in the context of India, they estimate that roughly 65% of people defecate outside on a daily basis. So that just, you know, we're talking about 650 million people, many of them living in this basin, just that alone is going to eventually wash into, you know, water bodies and get into groundwater. But also many people don't have sewage or indoor plumbing in a lot of these areas along the river.
My guest is Anthony Achavadi. His book from Applied Research and Design Publishing is Ganges Water Machine, Designing New India's Ancient River. You may have seen his recent op-ed piece in the New York Times called The Ganges Water Crisis. We'll talk about that as well after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Anthony Achavadi. his book from a publisher called Applied Research and Design Publishing is Ganges Water Machine, Designing New India's Ancient River. Now, we talked a lot, because it's the 10th anniversary of Katrina, about the impact of a hurricane on a major city. What happens when the monsoons hit the Ganges?
So when the monsoons hit the Ganges, cities oftentimes, especially kind of to the eastern, the second half of the river, oftentimes will flood, villages will flood. But a lot of times also what happens is cities and farmlands will also get flooded to the west as well, because these what they call nalas or drains start to back up from the river.
Now, when the Nile flooded, that was a source of agriculture in ancient Egypt. Do the floods have a good purpose?
They definitely do. They are what help make the Ganges River Basin one of the most kind of fertile river basins in the world. All of the sediment that's being shed from the Himalayas really makes it such a rich place for agriculture.
And since this happens every year, is there an official or even unofficial plan for dealing with it?
There are definitely plans at the kind of national level and state level and even municipal level for a lot of places in terms of dealing with flooding, dealing with the sediment that's coming down the river. But even still, there's not, I would say, a kind of coordinated effort to better understand the kind of the spatial dimensions of the monsoon.
The monsoon season runs from June to September. Are there often droughts at other times of the year?
Yes, so that's one of the kind of stark kind of extremes that take place in this region. You'll oftentimes, say, in a place like Uttar Pradesh, have some of the most drought-prone areas in India, along with some of the most flood-prone areas. So it's an extreme kind of laboratory for these different types of drought-prone areas and flood-prone areas.
And when it rains heavily in a drought-prone area, the water usually doesn't have the same impact it would if you just had rain every couple of weeks.
Definitely. And so that changes kind of the psychology of how people see water and how they use it, and then also the kind of ways in which they try to store it or, try to push it away.
What does your title, Ganges Water Machine, refer to?
So there was a great paper published in 1975 by a gentleman, Roger Revelle, and another gentleman named Lakshmanaya, who published this paper called The Ganges Water Machine. And their argument was to think of this river as a kind of large water machine, not just in terms of the kind of infrastructure, but even the cycles of weather, the groundwater, thinking of it not so much as a kind of just a purely kind of ecological or environmental context, but really trying to understand the mechanics and how those intersect with society.
You write that the Ganges is the most heavily engineered of the world's major rivers. We're talking about dams, bridges, canals. What else?
Dams, bridges, canals. Also, the river basin, there's probably one of the largest number of what they call tube wells or private bore wells that are speckling the basin as well, that allow people to draw up water from underground at, on demand.
And that's something you wrote about in your New York Times op-ed, the tube well system in what do they do?
So in a lot of areas where you don't necessarily have access to surface water, like, say, a lake or a water tank year-round, people have used this mechanized pump system called a tube well. And they'll use that so that they can draw water up from aquifers, oftentimes very kind of high water table level aquifers, to be able to use water on demand. And you find these both in cities and you find them in the countryside as well.
How are the tube wells powered?
So oftentimes they're powered with diesel engines, because electric engines are oftentimes unreliable, because many parts of the Ganges River Basin don't have regular electricity.
Using the Ganges as a water machine goes all the way back to the 19th century. Yeah. The British saw problems there, or what were they trying to do?
So the British, they restored a number of canals around the area of Delhi, the New Delhi, the national capital, but they also were very interested in how they could use canals to help increase production of agriculture, but also stave off famines. So in 1854, the largest canal system in the world opened, the Ganges canal system at the time.
Larger than the Erie Canal.
Yes. You know, the Erie Canal, when it opened, was just a little under 400 miles long. This Ganges Canal, when it opened, was 898.
Does it run alongside the river?
So it runs alongside the river for the most part through this area called the Ganga Jamuna Doab, which means the land between the Ganges and the Jamuna rivers. But it also at times has to cross rivers, so, or go underneath rivers. So they have all of these incredible infrastructure pieces that they call super passages to carry the canal over the river, over rivers, and sometimes carry it beneath.
The Erie Canal was created largely just to bring products by barge, but these canals are more about controlling flooding, aren't they?
Yes, so they're definitely, the intention was for agriculture, for watering areas that maybe didn't always have water year-round, especially in the months leading up to the monsoon. It's only probably towards the end of the 19th century where it's really conceived of as also a system for navigation.
Are the tube well system and the canal system interconnected?
So they're not interconnected. They're not oftentimes thought of as being interconnected, but they ought to be. And one of the reasons is that a canal oftentimes will raise the water table level around it because it leaks. So those are actually probably the best spots to put a tube well because the water table level is very high. Plus, oftentimes around canals, you'll have standing water, and that creates problems in terms of breeding grounds for malaria. So there's actually a kind of reciprocity, or what they call conjunctive irrigation, that would be better suited to these parts, which is happening in places, but should happen more.
Is malaria a big problem along the Ganges?
It's definitely a problem, you know, that still faces a lot of people. You know, people get it, oftentimes will die, especially children. So it's still definitely an issue.
And people bathe in the Ganges. So are they putting their lives on the line when they do that?
Well, they definitely are coming into contact with a lot of toxic chemicals, with a lot of sewage, a lot of other elements that definitely can lead to things like jaundice and other sicknesses.
There's a lot about the history of building the canal in this book. Is this the kind of huge project of the sort that we saw with the Suez Canal and the Panama Canal also in the 19th century?
Definitely. There's a kind of heroic dimension to building these canals, and there was definitely an idea that technology, the canal technology the British would inscribe into India, could help help alleviate kind of pressures of famine and also increase agriculture.
Do any of these things apply to other parts of the world, or is this a uniquely Indian situation?
So they definitely apply, and there was definitely a moment in time where you had a lot of people coming from Arizona and California to India in the 19th century, looking at the canal systems and just being amazed by it and wanting to build similar canals in Arizona, California. A lot of administrators would come from India and actually sometimes work in parts of California as well in the 19th and early 20th century.
You called your op-ed piece in the New York Times the Ganges water crisis. Well, we have a water crisis throughout the American Southwest. Are they similar in any way?
They're definitely similar, I would say, in the sense that the ways in which there are extreme droughts in parts of India and the ways in which there's both a kind of centralized water system that we have, both in India and, say, in parts of California and Arizona, but there's also this decentralized system of all of these pumps and wells. And, in fact, these tube wells, USAID in the 1960s looked to Madera County in California, which is now dealing with a lot of problems of groundwater crisis, as a model for India to develop. So there's definitely a lot of back and forth in terms of the history of these two places.
One of the problems in California is that the population keeps on growing, and that puts more and more demand on the sources of water. Well, India is projected to actually have a larger population than China within the near future. How does that affect water?
Well, it definitely affects water in terms of making water critical, and water wars have already been going on for some time in these areas. There's a great deal of conflict between water for agriculture and water for industry and water for kind of urban residents as well.
In the United States, part of the water war problem is connected to the policies of various states that draw upon this water. Sometimes they are almost at war with each other Does the same sort of thing happen in India where there are states?
There are definitely states that have to negotiate water rights. There are canal systems that, say, are put in place to divert water to the capital of India, New Delhi, that must first go there before they're sent further downstream. But also there's kind of regional and kind of international water issues as well with the Ganges.
How do the debates over public and private management apply here?
Well, so you have a kind of public system in place, but it's really not able to deliver water to many parts of cities and kind of the countryside. So there's really a kind of what people call oftentimes informal economy or kind of do-it-yourself economy to water. And so it's really unregulated, this kind of tube-well economy that we were discussing earlier.
How has the national government of India reacted to this crisis?
Well, there's under the new prime minister, there's definitely a push to try to clean up the river and to address many of India's kind of issues with the Ganges in terms of pollution and in terms of kind of electricity and hydropower as well. So there's definitely an interest. I don't think there's really a kind of clear plan yet, though, of like what's going to be the implementation strategy. How are we actually going to really try to address these problems and issues at kind of different scales?
Now, in this country, I know one of the other problems that the drought areas face is that the rivers are drying up to some degree, not just because people are drawing the water out of them, but because there's less ice melt. Is the same thing happening with the Himalayas feeding the Ganges?
So there's definitely issues with the glaciers melting, but probably, by and large, we're talking not more than 10% of the water budget. So the yearly water that passes through the Ganges is actually from the Himalayas. It's mostly dumped during the monsoon season. So these are still primarily monsoon-fed rivers. That said, there are a lot of dams that have been put in place that divert water that are affecting these rivers for sure.
Are the tube wells causing the water table to fall?
Yes, sometimes you'll have tube well levels or groundwater levels dropping dramatically in some areas, sometimes by 2 and 3 meters a year.
Was part of your mapping project an attempt to count the tube wells?
Yes, so I didn't know much about tube wells until I arrived in India, and oftentimes I'd go mapping very early in the morning, going by foot and by boat. And when I would go by foot, I would often very early in the morning hear the sound, this purring of these machines. And it turned out I would find a diesel-powered engine running to pump groundwater up. And a lot of times people didn't want to tell me how many tube wells they had or how many were around there because they don't want other people to know because the water table levels are dropping. So it's a very kind of curious situation there where no one knows how many millions of tube wells there are in India because it's a completely unregulated economy.
Is this book being published in India?
So it's been published, it was printed in Hong Kong, and it's being distributed in India and around the world. You can buy it in India, buy it in China, Europe, United States.
And have you gotten any feedback from India?
I've definitely gotten quite a bit of positive feedback from colleagues there in terms of the project because they can definitely appreciate the kind of arduous task of really walking most of the length of the river and traveling by boat over 10 years to map it.
Didn't you have some unusual adventures during the project, like being confronted by a group of armed women?
Yes. There was a moment when I arrived pretty early on, and I was with a car and driver going over this very large canal system we passed. And so I said, we have to stop. I want to see this. I want to document it. We did, and then we started following it. And at a certain point, the driver just said, he stopped me. He's like, I'm not going any further. And so, and I'm asking why, and he signaled to these dacoits, these bandits. So I said, well, okay, I'm going to get out and keep walking. And he said, do whatever you want. I'll wait here.
Well, he was afraid of bandits?
Yes, he was afraid of bandits. He was worried because there's large areas of the area that I work on, especially at that time in 2005, 2006, that were controlled by what the government has oftentimes called Maoist rebels or Naxals. Mm. And that's probably what these three women were who held me up at gunpoint, wondering what it was that I was doing there.
And did you have to give them hand over your research?
No. I was getting ready to make a panorama, and then all of a sudden I start to notice these women coming toward me, but I don't think much of it. And then when they're only maybe 5 or 6 feet away, they whip out machine guns and point them at me.
Where will your research go from here? Will you continue to study the Ganges, or are you interested in looking at other rivers?
So I've done quite a bit of work looking at parts of the Mississippi Basin, but also some work with the Murray Darling as well in Australia. So I'm definitely still interested in kind of the relationship between rivers, cities, agriculture.
And in the case of the Mississippi, hasn't the water level gone down considerably?
It definitely has in certain portions.
Well,
of
what
the river.
Impact is that having on some of the major cities that are along the Mississippi?
Well, it definitely has an adverse effect, I would say, especially for kind of the tributaries that are running off of the Mississippi in terms of water levels dropping or kind of more prone to flash floods in certain portions of the basin.
And like the monsoons, did Katrina have an impact on the delta?
For sure. I think it definitely did.
Okay. Ganges Water Machine, Designing New India's Ancient River. Anthony Achavati, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you, Leonard.